Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy mid-May, comrades.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to dip our toes into the turgid torrents of the Rio Grande here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors at Donors Trust, the principled and tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving. Friends, did you know that left-wing mega donors are shoveling money into pet projects that don't reflect American values? Lawmakers continue to push bloated big government policies like so-called student loan cancellation that invariably raise prices and fail to improve the underlying problems. All is not lost, however. You can help turn the tide with a charitable giving account at Donors Trust. Donors Trust is a refuge from the storm of harmful progressive philanthropy and big government wheeling and dealing that hurts not just our institutions, but our loved ones. Donors Trust helps you maximize your giving while minimizing your tax liability. Whether it's defending free speech, funding educational alternatives, or fighting green energy extremists, Donors Trust is the charitable giving account provider for you. Visit www.donorstrust.org/reason to learn more. That's www.donorstrust.org/reason to learn more about how Donors Trust can minimize your tax liability and maximize your giving. Yes, visit www.donorstrust.org/reason today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, on Friday, President Joseph Robinette Biden II lifted one of the last remaining federal emergency pandemic restrictions, a March 2020 Donald Trump order called Title 42. Title 42, whose authorizing statute stipulates that it shall be deployed to prevent the, quote, introduction of diseases into the United States, was used for 38 months to change the way that border officials process asylum requests. Before that, refugees, defined as people unable or unwilling to return to their home countries due to past persecution or a well-founded fear of future persecution, could arrive at a port of entry, apply for asylum, and then be released inside the country as they awaited a hearing, a practice colloquially known and criticized as catch and release. Title 42 instead just told people knocking at America's front door to turn around and go back. An estimated 2.7 million such expulsions have happened since then, many of them repeated attempts by the same people. In the run-up to Title 42 finally ending on Friday, masses of immigrants began surging towards and sometimes wading across the southern border. Just chaotic scenes on TV. Then Biden announced a replacement policy. He'd been teasing it before, one that resembles Title 42 quite a bit, telling applicants that they need to go back to Mexico and apply through a government app. The enforcement of the new rules appears preliminarily to have dissipated the swarm at the border, at least over the weekend, while drawing critics both from right and left, including a lawsuit from the ACLU. Catherine, Reason's Elizabeth Nolan Brown, if that is her real name, did one of those question headline thingies on Friday. Is Biden replacing bad immigration policy with worse immigration policy? So how do you, Catherine, answer that question?
Yeah, I will say, like, the asterisk on the answer to question headlines is always no, is, you know, actually, usually question headlines are like, this is a tough one. And this is a tough one. So happy to see Title 42 revisited at long last. And of course, it did not achieve one little smidge of its public health goals, as far as anyone can tell. And I'm sure that that's controversial because there are lots of people who will want to claim that keeping people out did help our COVID numbers. I don't know of any strong evidence for that and highly doubt it. But yeah, you know, there is no party of immigration in this country right now. There is no party that is like, hey, what it says on the Statue of Liberty, let's do that thing. And Biden campaigned a little bit like maybe he was going to be that guy. And I will be continuing to hold it against him that he turned out not to be.
Hasn't he, though, changed some policies and done things that are not pure continuations of his predecessor?
Yes, absolutely. There have been some things that are better. And, you know, I do think with some of Trump's policies, as the left was fond of like embroidering on napkins or whatever, the cruelty was the point. But the underlying, you know, effect on the world is not substantially different under Biden. I really, really wish it was. He fixed some stuff. He's a smidge better. But there are just still millions of people who want to come here, who should be able to come here, who would be an asset to our country, who are being told in just more complicated and more polite language that they still can't come here.
Peter, Catherine talked about the public health kind of rationale and implications of the thing. If you can, talk us through, with your trademark brevity and wit, what those implications are, even just in terms of the government's authority to use public health as a reason to do a big thing.
So because this is named Title 42, I feel like I have to make a Douglas Adams reference.
Yes.
Right. And
always.
In the way
yeah,
that
you
like,
have to.
Yes.
It's in your contract.
Right.
So
in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, they, of course, set up a giant machine to discover what the answer to life, the universe and everything is. And it turns out that it's 42. Well, for policymakers during the pandemic, the coronavirus was the answer to life, the universe, and everything. It literally was an excuse to do absolutely anything you wanted to do, whether or not it had anything to do with the coronavirus. And hence, we got Title 42 out of that, because Title 42 was just an excuse to turn people away and to keep asylum seekers out and to be much more aggressive with asylum seekers than we otherwise would have been. And that's all it was. It was just like we already wanted to do this. And because of that, because of the pandemic, we're going to go ahead and do that. And so it's probably illegal. I mean, right now there's a bunch of litigation. This will the end of Title 42 will probably stop that litigation. But if you think about what this basically said was the CDC has the power to decide immigration policy for the country. That's not how the CDC works. So we've talked a lot on this podcast about how the CDC played national landlord during the pandemic for some parts of it. But they also were playing national border enforcement and border policy organization. And that is not how public health works. That is not a power the CDC has. And yet it is a power that the CD took and held on to for several years via Title 42. It's so in addition to all of the kind of specific bad immigration effects here, it's also just a huge power grab by public health authorities that is probably going to have some very bad knock-on consequences in coming years.
Nick, you like to describe yourself as being in favor of open borders. How do you explain to an average American watching their TV set, an average libertarian podcast bro out there, keeping it real, that the chaos that they're looking at would be improved by a Gillespian open borders regime?
Well, you know, first, Matt, I want to point out, because 42, of course, is a famous number in the history of baseball.
Correct.
And I really need to talk about how the real problem is that it's besmirching the legacy of Jackie Robinson, who I think would have been in favor of letting more people cross the border, especially if they could do any combination of hit, field, or bunt. But there's a couple of things to think about here, and I you know, we're going to be talking about other topics that are related to this. What we're witnessing throughout almost every aspect in terms of federal policy is like a complete systems failure. We are a fat old man who did not take care of himself at all at any time during a 225 year lifetime, and now they're
Isn't
complaining.
The royal we?
Yes, it is the royal we for a democratic republic, right? But it's, you know, it's like everything is falling apart, and the immigration system is probably more like that than anything else. And one of, you know, the main issue here is that for decades now, at least since the late 80s, we have not had comprehensive immigration reform, because neither of the parties, you know, and Matt, you have documented, I think, more fully than anyone I know in kind of political journalism about how in the 90s, it was the Democrats who were the party against immigration, especially illegals, you know, and then that flips and switches with predictability, you know, depending on who's in office and a variety of other things. But our immigration policy is broken. And so every aspect of it is broken. It's like a fractal, you know, absolute foobar, you know. So the problem here is that, you know, you have to start with the reality or the understanding that governments do not control mass migrations. From time to time, they can control borders. And, you know, and totalitarian countries are pretty good at keeping people locked within their countries. But that's about it. Over time, the borders become more fluid. What's going on now is there are a number of countries in Central America in particular that have really awful economies, awful cultures, awful political systems. And there is a surge of people who want to get out. And it's independent of whatever the U.S. is doing. That's kind of the backdrop. And then on top of it is the fact that we as a country have not done anything to really significantly increase the processing capacity, particularly along the southern border. Biden has done some good things on this, and it's worth noting that he is better than Trump in a basic, limited, but profound way. But that's the big issue here. To get to your more specific point, you know, I was looking, Alex Narasta is one of the people that I look to for, good immigration analysis. He is very pro more open immigration, which is how I define myself as well, because open borders is simultaneously a meaningless phrase and one that is fraught with things like that. But the fact of the matter is that when immigrants come here, whether they're legal or illegal, they use less welfare than they consume, and they add to, you know, the public resources first and foremost in terms of goods and services provided, and secondly in terms of things like taxes paid. The immigration system that we had up through, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 19th century, and then the European Restriction Acts that effectively choked off Europeans starting in a big way in the 1920s. The policy that we had before that worked very well. And it worked because most of the people, overwhelming majority of people who come here, want to come here to live and work peacefully and productively. This gets to a larger question. You can do cost-benefit analyses. Immigrants do not cost us money when they show up, but people aren't going to believe that. I think the solution is first having an immigration system that allows more people to be checked to make sure that they don't have communicable diseases or violent criminal histories. Absent that, anybody should be allowed to come here. You can meter it out, because if everybody knows this is true, instead of waiting on a hypothetical, you know, list for 25 years to come from Mexico, if you know you're going to come in 2 or 3 years because we're actually processing people, that would reduce some of the tension on the southern border as well. We are in a beyond the system failure of immigration and of the economy and of government debt that we're going to be talking about in a little bit. We don't have a national purpose, or not a national purpose, a national identity that will allow us to take in anybody. And that's also a major system failure. Like, we need a way of understanding how America is, should be, and always will be, whether we like it or not, a country of immigrants, if we want it to be a place that anybody wants to live.
Catherine, let's talk about some of the ways in which the Biden administration is different than the Trump administration. One of the innovations or moves that the administration has done is launched a thing called humanitarian parole, first in Ukraine, I think, maybe the Afghanistan had some overlap, and now for Latin American countries that are kind of basket cases. This hands out 2-year visas to refugees who pass a Nick Gillespie background check and have private sponsors guaranteeing that they'll take care of them for 2 years. What policy lessons should we or have we learned from that?
I mean, this is a rare case where we tried something, it worked, and we learned the right lesson, as far as I can tell. So a surprise kudos to the U.S. of A. for that one. When you let people in under these clearly defined conditions, it works. Like, you have not, in fact, heard about the massive wave of, like, crime and disease and dysfunction and cultural decay caused by the fact that we've let in really, you know, quite a few quite a few immigrants under these programs. But it still has this kind of deep fundamental misunderstanding, which is like somehow Joe Biden can tell, based on your country of origin, who deserves to come here, right? Like there's this notion of like the worthy immigrant. And I think it really corrupts a lot of the conversation around immigration the same way that we are, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember like the concept of the deserving poor, right? Like there's this, it's to try and divide people into these categories doesn't make sense. Like, oh, if you're fleeing socialism, you can come, I guess. Or this specific war that happens to have currently captured the national attention, you can come. Or maybe like the war we started and destroyed your country with, like, sorry about that. Come on over. Like, it's not that those aren't defensible. They are, but there are plenty of people in countries not on these lists who live just like manifestly worse lives, who are struggling much more because of the political or social nature of the place that they're coming from. So it's just weird to make a list that's like just this little list for whatever reason. You guys get an easier path in. That said, any additional person who comes in under a clearly defined path peaceably, I'm for it. And this is for those who enjoyed Brian Kaplan's comic book about immigration. The last chunk of that is basically like, okay, I've done my best to convince you about open borders, but if I haven't convinced you, here are all the concessions that we could theoretically make that would still let more people in. And we could, I'm open to making those too, is kind of his rhetorical stance. And I guess I agree with him on that.
Hey, Catherine, I'm actually just curious about something you said there. You said, you know, that we've let people in under this rubric, and yet we've not heard about this massive wave of crime and disease and decay. And I guess my question is, haven't we? I mean, wasn't Title 42 predicated on preventing disease? And aren't Republicans saying in part that Biden's border policy is responsible for upticks and crime in disarray in cities? I mean, I feel like I am hearing the argument that like San Francisco is scuzzy because of Biden's border policy, that New York is has become a crime ridden hellhole again because of Biden's border policy. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I do feel like that is an argument that is being made in our politics right now.
I will slightly amend what I said. I think there was a moment a few years ago when there was like, there were some very narrow arguments that were being made. It was like, you know, there were a couple of stories of like a specific, drug trafficking story or whatever. I feel like, though, just as a matter of political gamesmanship, most of the energy there shifted to just being mad about what's going on at the border itself, which is a totally different causal story. So, yes, you're right. There was a minute when, like, as a messaging strategy, some Republicans experimented with, it's Biden's fault that man is screaming in Spanish on the street corner in San Francisco. But I don't think it took off. And I think that's because people recognize that didn't match up with their reality.
There was also, you know, there was that spate of stories of how illegal immigrants drunk driving were killing beautiful blonde children, you know, at Fisherman's Wharf.
But that's
in San Francisco,
eternal, right?
That peaked. No, yeah, but I mean, you actually don't hear that very much. And one of the things that's interesting, living in New York City, which is, you know, catching up to San Francisco as the, you know, patient zero of American urban decline, nobody talks about it. It isn't immigrant homeless people that are being choked to death. It isn't, you know, it's not, God, I just miss the days when I could understand insane homeless people screaming at me before they die of a fentanyl overdose. It's been deracialized in a way, or rather de-immigrantized. It might be that it's Black people, but you don't really hear that very much. And I think partly it's because it reflects, you know, Republicans are not bound, like all politicians are not bound by reality. But the fact of the matter is that the, you know, when people complain in New York City, and Matt, help me out here, or disagree with me.
Matt, you're a person who complains in
immigrants.
New York City.
No, but it isn't. It's not. They're not ups. It's not immigrants causing the street level urban decay. Unless you're going to say, oh, well, you know, old Chinese ladies are such easy targets, you know, for people who punch them in the face, that we need to get rid of them. It's not about immigration. At least I find in New York, you know, in discussions of urban problems.
I don't necessarily agree with your two characterizations about that, in that, for example, just this past week, New York Mayor Eric Adams announced that he is going to open up three public schools, not in Manhattan, incidentally, to house migrants who are coming here, the migrant populations. He also announced that he's going to have to amend the standing New York City rule where you have basically a right to shelter. That's why you don't have a lot of tents in New York, but that the system has been overwhelmed by migrants in a way, and he's trying to get relief from the Biden administration. So it's part of the conversation. There's, you know, some of the hotels around Port Authority have been swollen with migrants, and then they were shipped off to a facility near IKEA, not far from where I live, and then they're all mad because
and he wants to send them to Newburgh.
Yeah. I've definitely
fate worse than hell.
I've definitely heard Republicans tie immigration policy to upticks in violence related to gang members, and also. I've heard Republicans talk a lot about how Biden's border policy is responsible for fentanyl overdoses, and which is a little bit of a different thing, but it's related to what Catherine was saying. And so I guess I just sort of I feel like Republicans to a great extent, and in some ways, centrist Democratic mayors are responding to Biden's border policy by saying this is too open, you're letting too many people in, and it's causing all sorts of social ill. And I think that's unfortunate, but I do think that there is a messaging response coming from the political system right now, coming in our political discourse, saying that it is that immigrants are to blame for the problems that society is having.
Yeah, I just want to put one more asterisk on here, which is like, I guess what I was talking about more specifically there was the humanitarian parole stuff in Matt's question, yeah. Right? Like, okay. No one
That's
is
fair.
Saying we have a wave of Ukrainian crime. No one is saying we have a wave of Haitian crime. And I think that, like, yes, the border is controversial. Yes, there is for sure Republican rhetoric around Democratic border policies, but it's a quite significant influx of a fairly wide variety of immigrants from these countries that have this special status. And that, as far as I know, has not evoked a kind of the same response.
Well, let's.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to like 10 years ago when people were talking about MS-13. Every crime that was committed in a mall in Arlington, Virginia was linked to MS-13, a dangerous Mesoamerican gang. When's the last time you heard people worrying about that? It's about wokeness now, and not immediately arresting all homeless people who are mentally ill.
I would predict that, given the fact we're just now seeing the beginning of the 2024 presidential primary campaign, and given the fact that the leader, dominant leader so far in the Republican Party, is Donald Trump, whose 2016 campaign in the primaries predicated on talking about the criminals that were coming in from Mexico and other places, and talking a lot about sanctuary cities, and talking a lot about a murder in San Francisco in particular. I predict we'll hear more about this, and that's going to be part of the ongoing conversation. In addition to, Peter, I think it was you were saying, the sort of the fentanyl, the kind of unspecific wave your hands fentanyl border. If you just get those in a sentence, J.D. Vance wants to have you believe, then you can win any election you want. You're going to hear a lot of like crazy, we need to bomb Mexico. We got to bomb the fentanyl out of Mexico. And then and only then can we make the sanctuary city safe. All right. That's enough free association on this particular topic for now. The Congressional Budget Office last week, Friday, I believe, came out with an updated budget look for the next decade, increasing the projected 2023 deficit to $1.5 trillion. I looked this up, so this must be true on the internet. If you stack up $1.5 trillion dollar bills, it would go up 100,000 miles, which is halfway to the moon. I just think that's kind of cool. This report comes in the midst, obviously, of ongoing discussions between President Biden and congressional Republicans over raising the debt ceiling borrowing limits. Peter, you eat CBO reports for breakfast. What should taxpayers and political consumers take from these updated numbers?
That's a lot of money, like a whole lot of money. I like your moon analogy because it does suggest a line of political messaging here that you love, Matt, very specifically, which is we need a moonshot for deficit reduction. Right? We need to have a smaller stack of moon money.
Sold.
This is the only moonshot that Matt Welch will ever sign on to.
Before you go on, let's talk about my best headline as editor of Reason Magazine. Was on my own.
Let's
column,
do it.
Called Good Night Moonshot.
I'd like to believe it's still in front of you.
Good Night Moonshot? That's great. Go on, Peter.
So you said $1.5 trillion, that's this fiscal year, but as the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget has already pointed out, the deficit over the last 12 calendar months is already about $2 trillion. So that's another however many miles towards the moon, right? Like in moon dollars, like we're much closer to the moon than even your analogy made us sound. And the
most 116,000.
Aggravating thing about this is that Biden keeps making, as like a central argument, not like an offhanded thing that's unscripted, like a little footnote here and there. No, as like a central argument, he keeps claiming that he has cut the deficit. And it is true that the deficit has fallen from its pandemic era peak, but his claim is based on the planned expiration of pandemic emergency spending, which most of which was a bad idea. But like we spent it and it was mostly deficit spending, about $6 trillion there. And so he's saying that because there was not another $1 trillion or another $2 trillion in additional pandemic spending, that because of that, he cut the deficit. This is like me saying I am cutting my household spending by not buying more bottles of overpriced collector whiskey or hi-fi stereo equipment. Like every bottle of Pappy I don't buy is saving me thousands of dollars, right? Every time I don't buy a pair of handmade Jod DeVore speakers, right? Like those, it's thousands of dollars that we're saving as a result. That is not how savings work. Savings work when you spend less, not when the money that you already spent stops spending. Right. So anyway, we're getting closer to the moon and it's really bad and it's a huge amount of money. And just to one more point of context here that I like to think about 13 or 14 years ago, Congress spent a year or so debating Obamacare, right? Debating the legislation that would become the Affordable Care Act. And there were multiple versions of that legislation. And one of the big problems with the early versions was that the Congressional Budget Office kept scoring them as costing over $1 trillion in the first 10 years. And so eventually they pulled a bunch of tricks, basically delaying a bunch of the spending and including a bunch of other stuff to sort of artificially bring the cost down. So they got the total price tag down to $940 billion for over 10 years. That was almost $1 trillion over a decade, and it was a huge amount of money, and it was so much money that the initial amounts, they were like, that's too much. We can't spend that. And now we're looking at, like I said, a $2 trillion deficit just in the last 12 months alone, $1.5 trillion on the table for this calendar year. And deficits are projected to go up and up and up over the next decade.
Catherine, you live in D.C. I get the impression from the outside that there are some like stalwart Beltway Democrats and journalists trying to get us all scared about the coming, default. On the global collapse, the default of the debt, because the Republicans are nihilists or something like that. But like, it doesn't feel like it's catching. I don't see a lot of actual panic from that, especially when Mitch McConnell's out there every single time saying we'll not ever default on the debt, ever, not even once. What's your sense of the panic level in D.C. about these negotiations?
Yeah, I think we might have collectively reached some kind of like national panic satiation level. Like all of our panic is maxed out. But now we don't have any panic left for the moon pile. And it's not the right. We did the wrong panic is what I'm saying. And I wish we could reallocate our panic. But at this point, I'm not confident about that. I I was Googling around because while I do have high levels of ambient panic about the national debt, I don't have sort of the interest in following it day to day that other people on this podcast might have. So I was like, oh, what should I say on the podcast? And I somehow did the right combination of search terms that the first result was a hit from the Heritage Foundation from September of 2019 with the headline, Refinance U.S. Debt While Rates Are Low.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Heritage. Done
yep.
good.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we got to refinance a lot of this debt in the next year or so. And I don't know if y'all know this, but interest rates are up.
Nick, we have finally arrived at the moment that you and I have been talking about for years. And no, that's not the libertarian moment. It's the moment when...
Sure ain't.
When the service on the debt annualized is as high as military spending, and we spend a lot of money on the military. We spend more on the military than Boog Powell spends on barbecued ribs, Nick Gillespie. Is crossing that threshold basically like the GIF meme of the guy like bobbing his head and then he puts the gun to his head?
No, it obviously doesn't matter anymore. And I interviewed Vernon Smith, the 2002 Nobel Prize winner for economics. He talked about how because the central bank is so accommodating to federal fiscal policy and whatnot, we've kind of gotten it. We're in a world where fiscal and monetary policy, there are no constraints anymore. You know, part of the arguments, and this is one of the reasons why I think the whole debt limit debate is just kind of falling flat this time, because everybody knows we're not going to default on the debt and we're just going to keep printing money. And the Fed is going to do whatever it can to, you know, keep things going until, you know, this is the longest cocaine binge in history. And it's like somebody in the back of the car, it's not just they found another big bag of cocaine. They have a factory back there that is processing cocaine. Eventually, we're going to run out of gas. We're going to run out of coca, you know, and it's going to come to a halt. But I don't think people are taking it seriously yet. And this is a real issue. Going back to that idea of like mass system failure, this is the big one in a lot of ways, because the real problem why deficit spending is so bad is because it absolutely reduces long-term economic growth. There's no disagreement about this. This is the one thing that all economists from all over the spectrum believe. You don't even hear modern monetary theory anymore because people kind of know that's a joke, but you know they want to keep spending. But this is, you know, this is the problem. And I don't know what it's going to be, Matt. Maybe if there's an immigrant who somehow, you know, is mentally ill and takes over a shopping mall and kills somebody on a drunk driving charge and it costs us $5 as taxpayers, maybe then people will want to roll back Leviathan. But it's very disturbing because none of the Republican candidates are, with the possible exception of Mike Pence, who's not really going to matter, are talking about changing spending. I interviewed Vivek Ramaswamy, you know, the moonshot Republican businessman candidate. And I said, what are you going to do about entitlement spending? Because that's what's driving deficit spending, et cetera. And he immediately pivoted to talking about economic growth, which is also a fake way out of this. Completely implausible. But nobody is going to be talking about cutting spending.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email question of the week here in a moment. But first, funny man Andrew Heaton has long been a beloved character on such recent TV hit videos as Libertarian Star Trek and Libertarian Star Wars. So it probably won't surprise you to discover that Mr. Heaton hosts a science fiction podcast called Alienating the Audience. Alienating the Audience is all about deep space explorations of science fiction, such as Robert A. Heinlein's Free Love Libertarianism, The Economics of Dune, Kurt Vonnegut and the Warfare State, and how Star Wars Andor embraces public choice theory. Guests on the show have included, but are not limited to, Peter Boghossian on what the first contact with aliens will be like, Jonathan Last from The Bulwark defending the Empire, Timothée Sandifer of the Goldwater Institute on Star Trek and the Cold War, and our own Sand Queen, Catherine Mangu Ward discussing the work of Dan Simmons. If you do not like science fiction, do not listen to Alienating the Audience, as there's an excellent chance your virginity will grow back. But if you do like science fiction, with some politics and economics thrown in, served fresh by a mid-level comedian, then check out Alienating the Audience wherever you get your podcasts. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, email us your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Connor O-R-T Linner, who is followable on Twitter at Connor, that's two N's, O-R-T. He writes, technology seems to be leading us towards surveillance authoritarianism. Given that current governments don't have much incentive to give power back to citizens, do you think the key to a libertarian future is through technology, encryption, Bitcoin, etc., or do you believe that current systems can be sufficiently reshaped? If they can't be reshaped, is engaging in politics effectively a waste of time? I shouldn't ask this to Catherine, but Catherine, what do you say?
Yeah, you really sent this one right down the slippery slope here with me. So I'll give the more measured answer, which is everything's a waste of time. Like, probably nothing you do matters. But if we have to pick a thing, if we're trying political reform versus make Bitcoin a thing, I think make Bitcoin a thing is probably your better bet. And you will find in Reason Magazine kind of both sides of this coin, right? Because it actually is quite tricky to say the only hope for anything good is if a bunch of the technologies that seem to be at an acceleration point right now take off in a useful and productive way. And that includes AI and a bunch of other things that people love to panic about. Also, though, if those same technologies are put in the hands of authoritarian monsters, not just our own, but also really, really, really bad ones like North Korea, etc., it's not going to go well for those people. Ron Bailey lays awake nights, our own science correspondent, lays awake nights worried about what kind of new surveillance technologies will do in the hands of the politically powerful. And he is right to worry. But I still affiliate myself with, you know, he did not think of this by himself, but Balaji Srinivasan, who really, to me, articulated just like we can only technologically innovate our way out of our political problems is, I think that's right. Like, I don't think we're going to solve the problems by all just getting together and talking it out. And like Matt Iglesias is going to give us a PowerPoint presentation and then it's going to be fine. Maybe there's no way out. But if there is a way out, it's probably some combination of exciting decentralized technologies.
Nick, you're an anti-nihilist technology utopian. What say you?
And also a nihilist, but I'm against myself, Matt.
Well, that's
I'm like the Steppenwolf of Hermann Hesse. I'm riven. Now, technology is always the solution to the status quo. And I mean, government is not the most important thing in anybody's lives, nor should it be. And if you're in a relatively free country, and technology is one of the ways you keep doing that. Bitcoin, yes. All sorts of dispersed, decentralized power, yes. In the 90s, at Reason, we were evangelizing for the internet. The internet has become the means by which people are surveilled by governments because the data is out there and they can tap directly into, you know, the equivalent of the central nervous system of Apple or, you know, any of what used to be called the FANG companies, although like half of them have changed their names. So you get more possible surveillance, but you get more freedom. And I don't think this is complicated. It's, you know, that governments are always trying to catch up to where technology is bringing us. And that we need to keep in mind the concept of lived freedom. Because of the end of, you know, a monopoly on information, just something about like travel. I was flying out. I'm in the Bay Area in California right now as we talk. As I was landing, I realized I had forgotten to book a flight from San Francisco to LA. So as the plane was landing, I booked a flight to, you know, LA. That's an increase in flourishing and in freedom and the ability to live however I want. All of that data also makes it easier for governments to track me. You know, we strap on our cell phones, which give leave a trail of wherever we are, and the government can access that. The point of politics now is to make sure that government doesn't get in the way of new technologies that are going to be great, like AI, you know, that they don't use stupid old forms of antitrust to break up companies that are making our lives easier. And most importantly, that we run a shotgun on government so that they can't just access data whenever they want for whatever purpose. But I think the record is absolutely clear. You know, including totalitarian nightmares, technology is always the means to a freer and better and more interesting world. Governments chase on to that, and we have to beat them off with sticks. You know, not unlike Peter Fonda and Warren Oates and Loretta Swit did in Race with the Devil, whenever the satanic people chasing them would catch up with them, they would literally beat them off the RV with sticks and golf clubs. That's the metaphor here, Matt.
Have we talked about Reason's robot-dog divide on this podcast?
There's a divide?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
the robot dogs can never die, maybe. So, no, there's
who
a divide.
Pro like robot dog?
I'm pro-robot dog, first of all,
Jesus
obviously.
Christ.
But second...
Don't call them dogs.
I think there's a real question just in general about the robotification of law enforcement, which is like, you know, humans aren't doing a great job at all. And canines, by the way, are not either. And maybe the robots seem kind of scary, but also maybe we could program them not to just rip people's faces off accidentally. I don't know.
Nope.
I think it's worth talking about.
Nope. Peter, tell Catherine why she's wrong.
Dogs are wonderful. Dogs and wasting time well are the two keys to a good
life. He is being
life.
Held captive by two giant dogs, people. You should understand that. And he's blinking, help me, help me.
I am currently sitting under a pile of bull mastiffs, about 210 pounds of dog, as I record this. And if I suddenly start going, oh! Ah, making like strange noises like that. It's because they have clobbered me to death. To the reader's question, I take Ron Bailey's worries about surveillance technology seriously. I think some of today's tech probably will be used for bad ends by state powers. Like that does happen, and we should try to stop it. And we should be aware of that and not just sort of dismiss that worry. But I'm a technological optimist. I think almost more than I'm like a policy technocratic libertarian type. Like I'm just a believer in the power of technology and the idea of technology and the idea of the future, which is an idea of technological advancement in so many ways, right? I think technology tends to empower individuals much more than it does state actors and state power, because individuals ultimately are always freer and less constrained than bureaucrats, than politicians, than state forces. And if you look at the history of technological advancement, the world since the Industrial Revolution, it is the history of advances in human freedom. And I frankly think it's hard to imagine a libertarian project, at least as those of us on this podcast conceive of it, but really kind of a libertarian project at all. It's not an accident that the libertarian idea is in some sense a new one, a post-industrial revolution idea. I think it's hard to imagine a libertarian worldview as we conceive of it that does not embrace technological advancement as a fundamental precept of what we think is good in the world.
It's also worth thinking about technology and activity that's technically outside the realm of politics eventually coming back around and completely disrupting politics. An example of that would be the way that technology has enabled a wonderful workaround to public K-12 systems in homeschooling. Homeschooling exists because there's an ecosystem around out there that you can tap into using internet technology and using the way that people can communicate with one another. And there's a whole like group of entrepreneurs that are associated around it who are really like doing interesting and wonderful work. And that plus the pandemic, when suddenly the numbers of homeschoolers like doubled, even I think came close to tripling overnight. It has since receded somewhat, but people got to learn this new thing. It wasn't necessarily the people who were doing this were engaging in politics. They were actually kind of disengaging from politics. But now, what do we see over the last 12 months? At least a half a dozen states have passed backpack funding, essentially, just saying the money that we spend on K through 12 education should go to the student. And that can include, in some cases, to people who are homeschooling their kids. So, yes, it does affect it eventually. I think, you know, the last part of the question is engaging in politics effectively a waste of time? One way that I think about this is that a lot of the ways that which we fool ourselves into thinking that we are engaging in politics is that we are getting mad passively at the television or the social media at what people whose politics we don't like are doing or saying about national events. And that activity, I think, is largely a waste of time and doesn't lead to any more happiness or positive policy change. The more policy change and I think also happiness in political engagement happens, I think, on the local level, including that's where most of education is done, among other events. But the way that we normally refer to politics, I think, is largely a consumption product, and it's not a particularly great one. And the more that we get away from treating politics as a consumption exercise, the more productive our actual engagement with politics will be. And that's the memo. All right, let's get to our lightning round. That's going to have to be in a lightning round. You may have heard last week that former president and current Republican frontrunner for president, Donald J. Trump, went on CNN in a town hall setting. Not long after losing a civil sexual assault and defamation lawsuit to writer E. Jean Carroll. Let's go around the table and each of us bring one takeaway. You get one about what we learned from the Trump town hall. Catherine?
The people who like him still really like him. And the people who hate him are once again building a scaffold around ways to pretend like maybe he is not a viable candidate for president when in fact he definitely is.
Well done in lightning fashion. Peter?
Trump isn't going away, and that is in large part because he is a demand-side phenomenon. And we've talked a lot about the ways in which he is sui generis, in which he is sort of a unique force of personality, and I think that's true to some extent. But he is also an avatar of what Republican voters want. He is somebody who delivers in a way that other Republican politicians are going to strive to deliver and take lessons from him, even if he is somehow or another not in American politics anymore. So if he's not around, GOP voters are going to look for if not Trump, then something Trump-like, because it is the voters as much as the man who are driving the Trump phenomenon.
Nick, what's the takeaway that you had?
The ratings were not great for this. They were good for CNN, but not good for regular TV or even cable news. And subsequent events that Trump hosted were apparently were canceled because of lack of interest. I think the town hall was the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
Oh, bold prediction, Gillespie. My takeaway was that it's pretty clear based on the reaction in the media and also even within CNN, there's a lot of turmoil there, the media has gotten itself into a nervous breakdown in its inability to handle Trump. There's just, you know, too many journalists right now see their job, I think, as not giving him in particular a quote unquote platform, even though he's a former president who is the leading contender for the presidency in the Republican Party at the moment until Gillespie's prediction becomes true, but that their job is to defend democracy by just sort of like putting a rope line or some police tape around him wherever he goes. I think that's a weird conception and of journalism, and that actually feeds into a major thing that makes him attractive to his own voter. So it's a mutually reinforcing doom loop. And you can see it's just going to be with us, I think, as long as he's a character and the media continues down its own road. All right. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
Yeah, I read Kat Timpf, the Fox News commentator and writer who's always on Gutfeld. She has a book out that was right at the top tier of the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction. You Can't Joke About That, why everything is funny, nothing is sacred, and we're all in this together. And among the things that she does joke about are cancer, traumatic breakups, aging, dead mothers, mental illness, religion, gushing wounds, and censorship. It's a very good, fun read, but it also is getting at something that I think is really worth discussing in outside of any kind of partisan context. It's a very good book. I highly recommend it. And we're going to be doing an event with her on Monday, June 5th in Manhattan.
Nice.
So I read You Can't Joke About That by Kat Timpf.
Catherine, you're Kat Timpf's mentor. What did you consume?
I am really looking forward to checking out her book. Have not done that yet. I have been watching a show that ended in 2021 that's a 22-minute sitcom, and I don't care what you people think. I'm recommending it anyway. It's called Kim's Convenience. It's set in a Korean-owned convenience store in Toronto. And it's just, you know, see the first part of our podcast. It's about actually how immigration is good, actually. And I guess the whole thing fell apart in 2021 because of internal fighting and probably like white people are bad or something. But the show itself is it's funny. It's it already feels like a show that you could never make because there are some racial stereotypes in it. And, you know, it started in 2016. So a reminder that the world is moving very fast on that. But also, you know, just a kind of a good, easy, funny show. If you, like me, sometimes just want to watch 22 minutes of something that is amusing before you go to sleep at night. Kim's Convenience. There
that, for some reason, brings to mind a piece in the New York Times in the Sunday paper that I highly recommend. It was just really delightful. A great Mother's Day piece. It was called Generation Connie. You guys see this? It was all about all of these Asian American women who are named Connie because of Connie Chung. And it didn't have to be Chinese American. You could be Vietnamese, Korean. The woman who wrote it is herself named Connie. It gets into why Connie Chung is named Connie, which itself is pretty hilarious. Her parents were from China. She was, I think, the first of their kid, their family to be born in America. And they were just sort of looking for a name, and they flipped through a magazine, and there's an actor named Constance something. So she's Constance Chung, but everyone who's named Connie because of Connie Chung is not named Constance. Anyways,
that is perfect.
Really great.
There is the daughter in this show is named Janet, precisely on those same vibes of like, we just thought maybe we'd give you a name that would help you fit in. And it's like, yeah, if she was born 50 years before, like it's good.
It reminds me that my, one of my friends growing up in Long Beach, his mom was Japanese. You'd have these unions between American GIs who served in World War II and Japanese women. There's quite a few in our neighborhood. And her name was Echo was her first name. And so she changed it to Judy, which I always thought was pretty great. That wasn't my what you, by the way. So I just snuck an extra one in there. And sorry for that. Peter, what did you consume?
I read the 2021 novel, The Lost Apothecary by Sarah Penner. It is maybe not something that I would normally have picked up, but it was recommended by a podcast listener, actually. And I am interested in debut novels, especially those that have genre elements and those that hit the bestseller list. And this meets all of those tests, and it is pretty enjoyable. It's a sort of a smart chick lit meets gothic mystery story set in two timelines, present day London and late 1700s London. Follows female characters in both. So in present day London, there is a 30-ish American woman who is there traveling. She has an interest in history. She's supposed to be there for a 10th anniversary trip, except that right before her 10th anniversary, she found out her husband has cheated on her. So at the beginning, she's there by herself. She's gone on the trip in sort of solo. This, of course, develops into further complications. And then in the past, there is a woman who runs a secret apothecary where she dispenses poison and sometimes other remedies to women who need help, including, in some cases, help murdering their husbands. So in the past setting, there's also a young girl who ends up intertwined in the story. And it's a sort of a murder mystery thriller type thing, but along with a story about finding yourself and following your passions and you know, figuring out what you really want in life and also kind of investigating the past and like enjoying learning about something new in your surroundings. And so it's just a readable, satisfying page turner. And I just want to say thank you to the listener who sent in this recommendation.
I am recommending something that it sounds like it's the kind of thing that Catherine or Nick would have already recommended, but that I would have forgotten about because I stroked out. It's the pop-up museum called Museum of Failure. When do you guys do this one already?
No.
Really? Well, that's exciting. So it's a pop-up museum in Brooklyn, New York, in the Industry City, which is over by some old like port warehouses and stuff that's been refashioned and reshaped, called the Museum of Failure. It's a pretty small area that shows a bunch of products that failed. And the spirit of it is to make you kind of rethink about failure as actually the path to success or the price of innovation and whatnot. In fact, it's so heavy in that way that I kind of found it annoying. But what I found most annoying about the Museum of Failure, and I do recommend that people go despite all of that, is that when you're in this Industry City place where they have all these big different buildings, everything on the website says it's in building two. And then you walk all around building two, and it's just not there. It's in building seven, which really exists. And it's really, really difficult to find in the place that it is. So I found that kind of hilarious. Museum of Failure failed to
figure out. I was going to say, the irony.
The irony is deep. But it has stuff like the Minitel, which my wife did not its inclusion there at all. The French proto-internet terminal that was great. It had a Trabant. I had an entire room dedicated to Elon Musk, which is kind of interesting. So it had his successes, but his failures, and pointing out that the failures outnumber the successes. So makes you want to think about the full picture. Had maybe too much Donald Trump and all the Trump stakes and whatnot, and Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos. My favorite two awful things in there were Seagram's. Seagram's in the 90s thought, you know what? So many people like a beer and a shot. Let's make that into one drink. And call it Old Breed. That just didn't work out. And there was apparently...
Was it a separate shot glass in the can?
No.
Or was it just a...
Just like
whiskey-ish beer.
I mean, it was like honestly, like so many failures, it was just way ahead of its time, right? Because these days, the canned, like prepackaged cocktail and bottled beverage market is just blowing up. Like I was in a convenience store the other day that had a huge number of pre-bottled and pre-canned cocktails, but they also had Jack Daniels and Coke in a can. You don't have to buy Coca-Cola and Jack Daniels. You can just get Jack and Coke all to, right? Because it's way too much work to pour some Jack Daniels in
your
Coke.
We're going to see a real productivity
boost. Why are people trying to reform politics when Jack and Coke pre-mixed in a can already exists? Technology is the answer.
In the 70s, Matt, you'll be happy to know that you could buy Harvey Wallbanger cocktails on what became New Jersey Transit trains for the 45-minute commute home to hell. Yeah. No, it was all in the little can. And you would shake it and just chug it.
This is the future that libertarians want.
I'm always here for 1982 Brewers references, despite the pain that they inflicted on my particular team.
Yeah.
The
other Harvey's Wallbangers.
The other device that I liked because I hadn't seen it before was that apparently 12 years ago, they had a thing called the Twitter Peak, like P-E-E-K. It was a $200 device. So that you could tweet. That's brilliant. Anyways, Museum Failure, check it out. It's a pop-up museum. It goes until mid-June, I think, here if you're in New York. It'll probably and has reappeared in a lot of other cities. So you can look for it online and it'll tell you where it's going next, presumably. Kind of interesting. It's a little bit annoying, but some fun stuff to look at, including if you've never seen a Trabant in the flesh, they're always beautiful. And this one was a festive turquoise, which I always appreciate. All right, that's all the festivities we have in time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. podcast. If you like what we do, please go to reason.com/donate and give us a non or taxable donation or tax-free donation, however you say these things. All of our podcasts can be found at reason.com/podcasts. All of our events can be found, including the New York series of events at reason.com events. Nick, you mentioned the Cat Timpf speakeasy coming up. Are there any other highlights from the Gillespian multiverse that we should be aware of?
Yeah, that's on Monday, June 5th. Go to reason.com and sign up now because tickets are limited and they are going, you know, kind of like a Jack and Coke in a can.
Yeah.
Pre-made. But also on May 22nd, the next Soho Forum is a debate between Gene Epstein, the director of the Soho Forum, and Andrew Koppelman, a book that critiqued contemporary libertarianism as essentially spoiled by Murray Rothbardism. So those two are going to be fighting, like dogs and cats.
Who's going to moderate with Dr. Gene?
I'm very sorry to say that I won't be there. I was supposed to be the guest moderator, but they got somebody much, much better, a god called Judge Andrew Napolitano.
Oh, dear.
Will be the guest moderator.
What?
So check that out. All at reason.com/events or reason.com/newsletters and go to the NYC events and sign up for that great newsletter.
Brilliant. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.